Okay, so hello everyone. It looks like we have two people with videos on and seven people, students watching with videos currently off. Okay, great, there's more of you. Hello. I'll take this opportunity at the beginning of the class to suggest that all of you could turn on your videos if you're willing. It's, you know, nice for me to be able to see that I'm talking to somebody and not just to a blank screen. So that's good for me. It's I think also good for you. It helps you pay more attention if you know that you're on video. So that's not a bad thing as well. So yes, anyway, I encourage you to turn on your video if you're willing to do so. Okay, so last time, what we were looking at was this free electron gas in our box with periodic boundary conditions, which was Lx by Ly by Lz, where the Hamiltonian was the sum over all the particles of p squared over 2m. And what we found is many body eigenstates, which are given by this Slater determinant, where we take a bunch of individual orbitals that satisfy p squared over 2m for one particle, and then we construct this linear combination that's completely anti-symmetric. Those are all physical eigenstates. Each individual single particle orbital looks like this. It's basically just a plane wave with some normalization factor. But it's very important that the momentum is quantized by the fact that we have this finite box with periodic boundary conditions. So the first thing that we're going to do today is we're going to finish this story of the energy levels and the many body eigenstates in this free electron gas. And what we want to do is introduce a new concept which is the Fermi momentum and the Fermi energy, which we call KF and EF. So the idea is that if we have n particles, the many body ground state has electrons in the n over 2 lowest energy single particle eigenstates. And then the E energy for each one is h bar squared k squared over 2m, which depends only on the magnitude of k. Therefore, k less than some quantity kf will be filled, and k bigger than kf will be empty. And we can similarly, since there's a direct relationship between k and energy, we also define the Fermi energy in the same way, that all the states with E less than some value EF are filled, all the ones with E bigger than EF are empty. So this is our definition of KF and EF. define KF. We're going to do something that seems a little bit backwards. We're going to assume that we know KF, and then we're going to compute how many particles there are. What is N? And then we'll have a relationship between KF and N, and then we'll just say, oh, never mind, we don't actually know KF, what we know is N, and then we can get the inverse relation. So, we find N as a function of KF, then invert. Fortunately, inverting in this case will be trivial, but in general, it could be more complicated. So if we want to know the total number of particles, it's going to be a factor of 2. This is for spin, because we have both spin up and spin down filling each single particle orbital, times the sum over all momenta that are less than KF of 1. So it's kind of a trivial sum. Basically, this is just telling us the total number of orbitals that are momentum less than KF. And we multiply by 2 for spin. OK, does that make sense? OK, so now we come to the sort of tricky part, that this sum looks like it could be non-trivial. Because if you imagine, let's say, in 2D, that we have just kx and ky, then we have this finite grid of points. And if kf, basically, kf is going to define some circle in this grid. And if I try to plot what is n as a function of kf, it's going to look something like this. As the circle expands and encompasses another group of points, another group of points, and so forth. So if we want to deal with this discrete sum, that's going to be very challenging. Fortunately, we don't really need to deal with this problem. This is a problem if the spacing between k points is large. But as we saw in our eigenstates, delta kx is 2 pi over lx, and likewise for y and z. Therefore, as l goes to infinity, we can convert the sum over k to an integral over k, and that's something we can actually compute directly. So that's the procedure we're going to follow now. So to convert to an integral, the first thing we do is we need to have a volume element that we're going to be integrating over. That's this d cubed k. So I'm just writing 1 as d cubed k over d cubed k. And then this one we're going to treat as our integration measure. And this one we're going to treat as a constant you're going to pull out of the integral. So let's figure out what is this d cubed k. If we look at our delta kx and likewise delta ky, delta kz, this d cubed k is equal to delta kx times delta ky times delta kz, or in other words, 2 pi cubed over v, where v is the size of the box. So then this tells us that n is equal to 2 times times v over 2 pi cubed times the integral of k less than kf d cubed k. And then this piece here is just the volume of a sphere of radius kf, which tells us that n is equal to 2 times v over 2 pi cubed times 4/3 pi kf cubed. Any questions about this?
Should we add 1 to account for the 0 mode, or are we taking n to infinity so it doesn't matter?
It's the second one. Yeah, we're taking everything to infinity. That's sort of the idea of switching to the integral. Like, as long as we're looking at this discrete picture with, you have, you know, stepwise filling functions, then we have to be careful about that. But in this case, we don't need to worry about it. Yeah, and so in fact, what we're going to do now, we'll notice that this kf, if we solve for kf now, which is what we originally wanted to do, so now we're going to do the inversion piece. So we solve for kf. And what we see is that kf is equal to three pi squared times n over v to the 1/3. Yes? Did I get that correctly? I believe so. Yes. Okay. Great. So the thing that I want you to notice about this is that n and v only appear in the combination capital N over capital V, which is, in other words, just the density of electrons in our material. So that's good. That means that this is like what kind of state the electrons can be in. If the electrons if all the states of momentum less than kf are filled, then if I take my size of my material and I double the size of the material, that shouldn't affect the momentum states of the electrons. Basically, I could think of my two pieces of material as if they were one larger object or two individual objects. As long as they're all macroscopic, the momentum behavior of the electrons should be the same, basically. So. I didn't say that very well, but in any case, this, I have a better way of saying that. So let me switch boards, and I will say this again in a clearer way. Okay, so we have a result for the Fermi momentum. Can you still see that, by the way? I'm not sure where you're. Yes, you can. Great. Okay. So we can also then define the Fermi energy, which is just h bar squared kf squared over 2m. So this one, you'll notice, also depends only on density. I think I should actually postpone the argument about why this should depend on density, because I need to think about a better way of phrasing it. So I don't want to waste time giving you a less than perfect explanation right now, and we'll move on to the next topic, and I'll come back to this later on, probably in the next lecture. Okay. So actually, this is where I want to stop for now on the free electron gas. We're going to come back to it next week, or probably at the end of next week, or maybe even in the third week. And then we're going to discuss what happens at finite temperature. But for now, our goal is basically just to see how we turned single particle eigenstates into many particle eigenstates and found this Fermi energy and Fermi momentum. Okay? So I'll leave the free electron gas here for the time being. Okay, so we'll move on to our next main topic of the course, which is an introduction to second quantization. So I think that, if I'm not mistaken, you have all seen second quantization, at least some, in your quantum mechanics course in PSI. Is that true? Yes?
Yes.
OK. And so I'm not sure exactly what you learned about it, but I think that the perspective I'm going to give you will be maybe different, and we'll also do more practice with it than what you've seen before. So I think the normal way that it's introduced is by commutation relations, right? So that's probably what you've seen before. So that's not what I'm going to do. What I want to do is introduce second quantization as a solution to a problem that we raised in the previous lecture. Namely, we noticed last time that when we wrote down the many-body eigenstates, we had our full Hilbert space, and then we had a much smaller physical Hilbert space because all we require electron wave functions to be antisymmetric. So the way that I like to think about second quantization, at least sort of initially, is that it's a solution to this problem. It's a way of writing down our operators. We can write down operators more efficiently because they act only in this smaller space and not in the full space. So that's the thing we're going to try to do. So let me give you an example, a situation, and sort of introduce the operators within this example setup. So we're going to imagine we have three single particle orbitals. Which I'll call phi 1. Phi 2 and phi 3, and these are mutually orthonormal. Furthermore, I'm going to imagine that I have two electrons in my system. So the full many-body Hilbert space is characterized by the question, what is the state of each electron? In other words, we have 9 total states. Phi 1 tensor Phi 1, Phi 1 tensor Phi 2, dot dot dot, down to Phi 3 tensor Phi 3. So the dimension is the number of orbitals raised to the number of particles. On the other hand, the physical Hilbert space of this problem instead asks a different question, which is, which two orbitals are occupied? And the reason why is because we know that our two electrons can't both occupy the same orbital, because that wouldn't be antisymmetric. And furthermore, combinations like phi 1 tensor phi 2 and phi 2 tensor phi 1 also actually only give us with one state, which is the one where phi 1 and phi 2 are occupied and the overall state is antisymmetric. So this is a quite different space where instead we have 3 basis states. By 2, 3, and 1, 3, I mean the same thing I wrote here, but with the different orbitals involved. With instead of 1 and 2, it's 2 and 3, or 1 and 3. Note this can also be written as a Slater determinant. Like that. So the total size of this space is, instead of the number of orbitals to the number of particles, it's the number of orbitals choose number of particles, as in our combinatorial combinations, the number of ways to put the number of particles into the number of orbitals. So our question now is, can we write operators that act only in the physical space. The answer, of course, is yes. And the reason is that the set of physical states can be the basis for a state. And we can, you can always, once you have a basis, you can arbitrarily define an operator just by its action on the basis, right? Okay, so we're going to define some set of operators like this. Okay, so here's how I'm going to define my operators. So the first step is we're going to create a Hilbert space which does not limit the number of particles. So we're going to consider a space with n single particle orbitals. Which I'll call phi 1 through phi n, which are orthonormal. And the number of particles basis of the Hilbert space H is all Slater determinant states with less than or equal to n particles. So here's an example with the case that I was looking at before, which I just erased, I guess. But for three orbitals, as we looked at just before in our example, our basis looks like this. We have the state 0, which is no particles. Then we have the states phi 1, phi 2, and phi 3, which of course each of these is a trivial Slater determinant in the sense of it's a Slater determinant which contains only one item in the matrix, therefore the determinant doesn't do anything. So this is with one particle. Then we have our 1 over root 2, phi 1, phi 2, minus phi 2, phi 1. And then likewise, with 1 and 3 and with 2 and 3. So this is our two particle basis. And then we have the three particle piece, which is the full slated determinant of all three orbitals. Like this. And then the full dimension of this Hilbert space is 1 plus 3 choose 1 plus 3 choose 2, so that this 1 I can also write as 3 choose 0 plus 3 choose 3. So in other words, we have the sum of k equals 1 to 3 of 3 choose k. And then you may recognize this is just the coefficients of the binomial expansion. So this is, in fact, 1 plus 1 to the 3, or 2 to the 3, which is equal to 2 raised to the number of orbitals, which is another way of saying that every orbital can either be filled or not filled. And that's the full space that we are looking at. OK, does this example make sense? Do you understand how I'm defining the basis? Okay. So the usual rule in linear algebra is once you define a basis, everything else follows. So that's indeed what we're going to see here. So part two of our definition is given a basis state, which I will call psi, which is 1 over root n, this slated determinant. So we have n different orbitals, 1 through n, and then n different particles, 1 through n. So this is some state that's it's some basis state. Then we define the operator C dagger for orbital phi, which may or may not be one of the orbitals that's already here. The action of that on the basis state psi is defined to be 1 over root n plus 1 times slated determinant phi. I'm going to just write the whole thing out, then we'll discuss what this means.
Aaron, did you want to say the basis state to be means the n's should be means that's just one state, yeah? That's the last state where all n are filled. Did you want to choose an arbitrary one?
Thank you. You're absolutely right. So this it's bad notation. This should be a lowercase n.
Yeah, one of them.
Yeah, so I don't want to assume that this is the state with all particles filled. So yes, thank you for asking that. That's a very good point. Okay, yeah. So this is some lowercase n, which is in general less than n, although it could be equal to less than capital N, though it could be equal. Yeah, thanks for asking. Okay, so what I've done here is I've added a new row on the top of the Slater determinant, which has the new orbital phi that is associated with this operator C dagger. And then I also added a new column at the end for my nth plus one particle. So this is indeed another element of our basis. So this is has transformed one basis state into another basis state. So this is a valid operator within my space that I've defined above. Right? OK, so maybe now we can try to understand some properties of this operator I just defined. And I think the best way to do that, again, is to start with an example. So we're going to go back to the same case we looked at before, which is our three orbital case. And we're going to ask, how does the operator C dagger corresponding to orbital phi 1, the first orbital I defined, act on every basis state? So if we can answer that question, then we know everything about this operator C dagger. So let's begin. We have our basis. Well, I don't know if you can still see it on the screen, but it's here. Maybe I'll try to make everything visible together. Can you see the basis now? Yes? OK, great. So let's begin. So C dagger phi 1 acting on this state 0. This is kind of a case which my definition doesn't really cover. So let me add this as an extra caveat in my definition. That C dagger phi acting on the state 0 just gives you the orbital phi, since zero is not since this zero state is not technically a Slater determinant. So this is going to be phi 1. Okay, now let's do some non-trivial actions here. So C dagger phi 1 acting on the state phi 1 is equal to our Slater determinant like this. And this determinant is going to be 0 because the determinant of any matrix with two equal rows is going to be always 0, since it's antisymmetric in swapping rows. If I act, on the other hand, C dagger phi 1 on the state phi 2, then I get this state here, 1 over root 2 times this Slater determinant of phi 1 and phi 2. And this, you can recognize, is indeed just this basis state right here. If I now act C dagger phi 1 on phi 3, then I get basically the same thing. So I'll just say it's similar. If I act C dagger phi 1 on the Slater determinant, 1 over root 2 with phi one and phi two in it. Gives me 1 over root 3. Times this 3 by 3 determinant, which has two rows that are phi 1 and one row that's phi 2. So this thing, again, has two equal rows, and it's going to be 0. Likewise, if I act with C phi 1 dagger on the state, this later determinant of 1 and 3, which I'll just write this way, that's also going to be 0 for the same reason. If I act on the 2, 3 state, then I get the Slater determinant with one rows for phi's 1, 2, and 3, which is not going to be 0. And finally, if I act on the state with all where all orbitals are already filled, then I'm just going to get 0 because, again, I'm going to have two rows that are both phi 1. Okay, so now we're going to use all of this to find the matrix for C1. So letting our basis states be in the same order that we found them before, we can write this as an 8x8 matrix. Where I'm going to say that the state 0 goes to the 1 followed by all 0 state. The state phi 1 is 0, 1, 0, the rest zeros, etc., in order that we gave them before. And doing that, I'm going to divide up my matrix like this. And I'm going to label the rows and columns. So this is 0, so the shorthand notation I'm using here, 1 means that phi 1 is filled, 2 means phi 2 is filled, 3 means phi 3 is filled, 1, 2 means phi 1 and phi 2 are both filled. And then you get the corresponding Slater determinant. So that's how I'm labeling the rows and columns. And so what we found is that if I act C phi 1 dagger on the state 0, then what I get is the state 1. So I get something like this. When I acted on the state 1, I got all zeros. When I acted on 2, I got the state 1, 2, which is here. When I acted on 3, I got the state 1, 3, which is here. When I acted on 1, 2, I get all zeros because there's already a 1. Same thing with 1, 3. When I acted on 2, 3, I got the state 1, 2, 3. And then acting on 1, 2, 3 is already completely full. I can't add any more particles to it. So this is my matrix. It looks a bit messy, so let me rewrite this in a clearer way. So what I've done is I've divided into blocks, which are separated by number of particles. So this is zero particle block or zero particle rows. One particle, two particle. Three particle. And so of course, the matrix elements for this C dagger operator are all zero, except in these three blocks, which are the blocks that correspond to adding one particle. Okay, let me ask if there's any questions here. Okay. We've found the action of one of these C's on all basis states. So, we understand that it's a well-defined operator in this many particle space, but the way we've just done is a huge pain, I would say. Like, that's very inefficient. What we want is a better way of working with these operators. And here's where we're going to come to the commutation relations that you have, I believe, seen before in previous context. So a better computational approach is we're going to use commutation relations. So the first thing that I want to prove is that the anti-commutator of CI dagger and CJ dagger, where what I really mean is C phi I dagger and C phi J dagger, but I'm just, as the class progresses, we'll use more and more shorthand and, you know, be less and less careful in how we write the subscripts. But of course, what we mean always goes back to the picture we've talked about before. So here I'm just going to write this as CI dagger and CJ dagger. So this, of course, is CI dagger CJ dagger plus CJ dagger CI dagger. And to see what this thing is equal to, let's act it on a basis state. So CI dagger CJ dagger acting on some Slater determinant, which has, as usual, our orbitals. Let me use lowercase n, like this, is going to give us 1 over root n plus 2. Phi I through phi I, phi J through phi J, and then the ones that were already there. But now, if I swap two rows, I get a minus sign. Like this. And basically all I've done is by swapping the two rows in the determinant, I get a minus sign and I swap the order of the two C-Dagger operators. Therefore, I show that CI dagger CJ dagger is equal to minus CJ dagger CI dagger. Hence, let's write that again. We conclude that CJ dagger, CI dagger, ANSI commutator is equal to zero. As a special case of this, note that if we take one operator and we square it, then this, of course, is equal to 1/2 of ANSI commutator of the operator with itself, which is equal to zero. So every operator squared is equal to zero. And this makes sense because you're adding particle in this particular orbital. And since we have fermions and they can't have multiple particles in the same orbital, then this has to give you zero when you try to do this in your wave function. Okay, so another thing we're going to do is we're going to define the operator C phi I to be the Hermitian conjugate of C phi I dagger. Now, what exactly this definition means is, you know, not immediately obvious in terms of Slater determinants. Like, it's somehow taking away a row. So the procedure is you first move the row to the top, and then you remove it. Since our C dagger added the row at the top. But we know that it is well defined because since C dagger is a well defined operator, its Hermitian conjugate must be well defined as well. So we can also conclude that the anti-commutator of CI and CJ without daggers is zero. And that follows by just taking the Hermitian conjugate of both sides of this equation that we found in property one. And then finally, we have the non-trivial relation that the anti-commutator of CI and CJ dagger is delta IJ. That is, it's 1 if I and J are equal and 0 if they're not equal. So this one is less easy to prove. And in fact, I am not going to prove it for you. Instead, this is going to be a problem on one of, in your first problem set. So you'll try to show that using the Slater determinant. So that's something you're going to be doing in the homework. Okay, so for now, we'll take that for granted. But also on the homework, you're going to show this is true, but only if the set of orbitals is orthonormal. If the set of orbitals is not orthonormal, that property actually fails. So the fact that our orbitals are orthonormal is very important. Okay, so it looks like from the clock here, it looks like I have about 2 minutes left, I think, maybe 1 minute. So the very last thing I'll say for today is we're going to now rewrite our many particle basis using these C dagger operators. And by the way, I think I haven't said this yet. So we're going to give these a name. We're going to call them creation operators. Because they add a particle to the system. And C are called annihilation operators. Okay. So what I'm about to say now, I'll repeat at the beginning of the next lecture, since we're out of time, but I just want to finish this particular story. So in our example with three orbitals, our many particle basis is written as 0, C1 dagger acting on 0, C2 dagger acting on 0, C3 dagger acting on 0. So this is our single particle space. C1 dagger, C2 dagger acting on 0. C1 dagger, C3 dagger acting on 0. C2 dagger, C3 dagger acting on 0. That's our two particle space. And C1 dagger, C2 dagger, C3 dagger, 0. And those are our 8 many body basis states. So as you can see, it's a much nicer notation than this later determinant. This is something we're going to be able to do calculations more quickly. We don't need to write all that many subscripts and large determinants with lots of things in them. So this is a much more compact and useful, easy to work with notation. Okay, so that's where I'm going to call it for today, and we'll pick up again with this on Thursday morning.